Hi, I'm Michaela McGuirk-Scalaro and you're listening to City Road. In this last episode of the Infrastructure Governance series, Turan Alzadeh speaks with several of the incubator's key members to discuss the project's findings over the past 3 years. The panel draws from a case study of the Western Sydney Parkland City in New South Wales to focus on multiple critical issues previously discussed across the podcast series. I'll let Turan introduce our panel.
Please allow me by welcoming everyone who is here with us. We appreciate that you guys are joining us in this almost the very last session of the conference. Please allow me to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we operate across both Australia and New Zealand. My name is Turan Alzadeh. I'm an Associate Professor of Urbanism and Infrastructure at the University of Sydney. I am also the lead investigator on what is known as the Infrastructure Governance Incubator. And today we are here to talk about the findings of this project. This was a multidisciplinary 3-year collaborative research platform across 3 universities, University of Sydney, University of Melbourne, and Monash University, in partnership with PIA New South Wales and PIA Victoria, and was funded by the Henry Howland Research Trust for 2020 to 2023. So in a sense, the timing of SOAC 23 was perfect, as it provided us with an opportunity to report back to the urban planning research community and hopefully to generate meaningful discussion on renewing a research agenda for infrastructure governance focused on building more just and sustainable future approaches. And I have today with me most of the fabulous key teams of the Infrastructure Governance Incubator, plus a couple of close collaborators and discussants. But before going to them, I just want to point out that as part of this project, we made sure that we have a range of diverse outputs. And one of the kind of outputs that we had was a podcast series. Quite a few of them have already been released. And this final session is also being recorded. But without further delay, let's go and hear from different panel members. To begin, we have Rebecca Clements, the fantastic, fabulous postdoc on the Infrastructure Governance Incubator. And she will start by having a brief, relatively brief presentation that walks you through some of the major main findings of the project before we have a bit of a sectoral conversations on different areas of work. Rebecca, if you are ready.
I'm ready. Thank you very much. So Turan already gave a really good introduction, but just to start us off, in addition to Turan and myself, we have Litten Kamrazaman from Monash University, Crystal Legacy from the University of Melbourne, Glenn Searle from the University of Sydney had to go and get a plane, so he couldn't be here, and Dallas Rogers is presenting another session, so he got us all mic'd up and headed out. But this is the core research team of the Infrastructure Governance Incubator. So Turan kind of talked about our aim with this project, but it was to think about a lot of big themes through a major case study, which we selected along with our advisory board. So the advisory board for this project had quite a lot of industry professionals and scholars in infrastructure and planning authorities and organisations and people with that kind of expertise. And we settled on the Western Parkland City, which is in the western part of Sydney, as our major case study, but also complemented that with a systematic literature review, which we've published on and reported on at the previous SOAC. And so we were interested in looking at a lot of the interrelations of aspects like infrastructure planning, legitimacy, funding, and also the decolonization of infrastructure governance. And Ellie Davison, who we'll hear from today, will speak about that, but she was also one of our very important members of our advisory board. I won't go into these in detail. You can go to our website if you want to find any of these. But this is just to sort of talk about the fact that we had a range of outputs and plug-in projects with different partners like the Department of Industry and Environment at that time. Practitioner in residence positions got funded who were working on different aspects of infrastructure planning. Adjunct lecturer position, a PhD position, and we've supported Ellie and Michael Mossman's work in putting together a First Nations planning professional directory, which is just at the beginning stages. We've published several articles on our earlier sort of literature review work and have several other papers in review on the findings of this research. We've also been a part of a number of public and professional conversations with this work, at such as the Festival of Urbanism at Sydney, media pieces such as In the Conversation, and a range of other professional engagements such as with PIA or also with the Greater Cities Commission and things like that. And Turin mentioned the podcast series that we're nearly done with. We've nearly got all of the episodes out. So I highly recommend you go and check out our website. You can find all of the currently released outputs and we'll be working towards more, which will go up there. And just a very quick mention to the fact that just this research project is, we're kind of nearly done with those key outputs, but we've already got funding to kind of take a lot of these learnings into some scoping research with partners in the Northern Rivers and Lismore. So that's kind of where a lot of these learnings will be flowing into. So to come back to our case study in this research, the Western Parkland City is a massive long-term strategic planning project, which is a part of a major metropolitan restructuring of the Sydney metropolitan region. And this is really centrally catalysed through the funding of a new Western Sydney airport, which is still in its... The case study is still, you know, in its relatively early stages and still evolving. So this research has really been getting a lot of those findings from these early stages still unfolding. It's a very valuable case study as it has a range of novel governance approaches, such as a city deal bringing three levels of government together and things like place infrastructure compacts. It has obviously a very important dimension as it takes place on unceded Aboriginal country, and there are a range of other important aspects that Ellie will go into. The fact that the project is premised on spatial and equitable rebalancing of the metropolitan region, and particularly in terms of redirecting growth and jobs. And there's also a lot of major environmental challenges of this, the central greenfield development around the airport in a place which is highly vulnerable to climate change impacts such as heat waves. This is just a look at a kind of a tentative map of at least one point, what the kind of core governance structure sort of looked like. There was no formal map available, but this was us. This is basically just to show we were kind of trying to cobble this together and come to grips with what the structures of governance sort of looked like, at least in terms of the main authorities and their relationships with each other. And it was constantly changing, and it was very hard to kind of come to understand. Different people had different ideas about things. But in terms of the methodology of the case study, we undertook 56 interviews with 53 different participants, and these came from a range of different sectors, a lot of state government stakeholders, also local government, a very small number of federal government people because they're very hard to reach, people from NGOs, consultants and community organisations, some activists, and also academics, some of which are directly engaged in the project and some of which are just experts in the subjects we were dealing with. And in terms of their level within organisations, again, it was very wide-ranging. There were key top C-level executives all the way down to department heads, directors, senior staff, politicians. In terms of First Nation participants, we spoke to people who were within government positions, also those in the local Aboriginal Land Council, which is a formalised authority, and also traditional custodians and others who work closely with them. And I'm not going to go through all of these findings because this is the subject of the discussions to come, but this is sort of how we've structured the categories of our main findings around planning on unceded Aboriginal land, collaborative governance and integration, the capacity to address societal end goals, attention to accountability and transparency, and politics in infrastructure planning. So it became apparent that these were all really important areas of challenges or interrogation. Because it's not being covered in the other by the other speakers, I'll just lightly touch upon the societal end goals findings very briefly. So in terms of the place infrastructure compacts, one of the major sort of touted mechanisms being used in this case, they were really seen. Oh, and I should also mention that our interviews are anonymous, and that allowed people to speak more frankly, as you can imagine, in an ongoing unfolding case. So place infrastructure compacts were seen by interviewees as really critical for place-based planning, but in practice they were challenged by actor resistance and stark funding realities in a range of ways. One of the key frustrations that came up again and again across our interviewees was a frustration with a lack of clear staging and sequencing and a lack of joined up funding and investment prioritization processes across infrastructure funding. So even though you had the city deal, which was providing one kind of funding, you also just had the existing system, the existing reality of how infrastructure is planning. And in New South Wales's case, like in many other cases, it has a legacy of being very siloed. And the funding is also siloed. There was, in the bigger picture of this case, a lot of skepticism of its capacity to address the climate emergency and wider equity issues. So a lot of people had serious environmental concerns, and a lot of people felt that our systems are just still not set up to give adequate priority to things like important community infrastructure and enabling services, which are so important in greenfield developments. And because there was this focus on jobs right from the beginning and on shifting employment, which was recognised as an important aspect, people also felt that the industry focus risked dominating the other goals. Another key finding was that there was a real lack of clarity around the roles for things, important things like continued visioning, stewardship and oversight. So we'll talk a little bit more about different aspects of this, but one of the things was that one of the key authorities at the metropolitan level, the Greater City Commission, kind of this project was a big priority for them, a big part of their Three Cities strategy. They came in with a certain kind of visioning, but they were dealing with things at a metropolitan level. They also didn't have the mechanisms and the powers to sort of enable a lot of the things that they were talking about. And those powers and visioning responsibilities weren't really, people felt they weren't really adequately given over to the place-based authorities either. So it was, a lot of people felt there was this vacuum of these really important aspects. So I'll leave that there and hand over.
Thank you. Thank you, Rebecca. So you've heard quite a bit about the diverse areas of finding, and hopefully we'll get a chance to unpack them in our conversation in the next hour or so. But before we get to the finding, the very first big task that we took on was a systematic literature review that Litten led in close collaboration with Rebecca, the two of you really championed that massive exercise of systematic literature review. So without further ado, Litten, can you please briefly tell us about the systematic literature review that we conducted and the ways in which it informed the incubator's work?
Sure, thanks, Turan. I think being a researcher and sitting in this room, everybody has experience of doing literature review. This is what we do, so I'm not sure really what new I can say about that, but there were two main things probably I would highlight for doing the systematic literature review. The first thing was being published, because from my experience, what I see that after finishing 6 years of my PhD, I was still struggling to publish my literature review from my PhD thesis because it was not done in a systematic way. Whereas in the meantime, I have published like 50 different systematic literature review because those are done in a more systematic way. So that is one of the reason we followed that systematic literature review path. So if you want to publish something, I would say follow a structured method. Now, what is systematic literature review? There are, at least to my knowledge, there are 14 to 15 different types of literature review, like scoping review, meta-analysis, systematic review, traditional reviews, and so on, right? And there are very subtle differences between those different types. Often, One type of preview is merged with another type of preview to make it more robust. This is what we exactly followed in this process. So what happened that when I tried to publish my own PhD literature review, because it was not systematic, a reviewer came back saying, oh, you did not cite this paper that I wrote 50 years ago on that, something like that. So we needed to have some sort of justification why we did not include your paper, right? And that justification actually came from a systematic literature review, saying that because we have followed a specific guideline to select our literature on this particular topic, and your particular paper did not fall into that category. That's why we did not include. So you have some sort of justification. Now, what we did, we have identified that our target was because infrastructure and governance, this is the second point actually, infrastructure and governance, these are so confused terms. We have done 3 years of research. We, at the beginning, we were in the very darkness, what infrastructure means, right, or what governance means. After doing 3 years of research, if you ask me the same question, probably my darkness increased. We wanted to have some sort of clarity what people or researchers think about infrastructure and governance, right? So we wanted to bring all the literature out there to have some sort of understanding of what infrastructure governance means, right? So we identified more than 3,500, I believe, research article based on all the articles that are in Google Scholar and all the articles that are in Scopus, and we identified some of the duplicate articles. So that gives us, like, after removing the duplicates, 2,000 articles on infrastructure governance. Now, as I said, sometimes we merge two different techniques. So what we did a bibliometric analysis. This is another systematic way of doing it. Bibliometric analysis basically gave us an idea of the field in its entirety, starting from the beginning until 2021, I believe, or 20. It gives us how this infrastructure governance themes evolve over the period of time, what are the keywords people used, how those keywords are linked to each other, and what are the fields that are getting dominant over the period of time. Once we have identified that, then we somehow kind of have some knowledge about, okay, what are the key themes in infrastructure governance literature. Then we kind of identified 50 different themes. And then based on that 2,000 documents or research outputs, we narrowed it down based on their suitability for our project. We have narrowed down the literature to do, because it's very hard for any human being to go through 2,000 research outputs one by one and identify things. So we have narrowed down, again, in a systematic way, why we narrowed down, why this is not relevant, and why it is relevant, to somehow 350 documents around that mark. I cannot remember the exact number. 350 documents, and we have gone through, Rebecca has gone through, basically, I should say. Rebecca has gone through all those 350 documents on infrastructure governance. So if you have any question about infrastructure governance, Rebecca is the best person to answer in this world, I believe. So what we have identified based on those things, we identified that infrastructure, yes, it is a contested term. Governance, again, it's a contested term. The slides that Rebecca showed you earlier, infrastructure governance of the Western Sydney Parkland case, you see that there are so many lines going forward and backward, it's still very hard to grasp just in one particular case. Now, literature is saying that infrastructure has so many different dimensions. It may be a transport, it may be social, it may be community, it may be telecommunication, it may be, you name it, right? So everything they put some tag as infrastructure. Now you can think about just looking at the Sydney Parkland case study and thinking about 10 different types of infrastructure, and each of them have multiple components in it. So what would be the governance and how that governance structure would look like? So we thought, or we found that this is a very complex process indeed. So these multiple infrastructure dimensions are linked in a various way, and governance is kind of a connect connector between different types of infrastructure. So Rebecca has done a great job identifying how those different infrastructure link to through governance lens. And then from there, we have identified several other themes that emerged from those connection things, like politics and so on. So I believe you'll talk about that, right, later on. So I'll not go into that detail. But what we found a kind of key takeaway message from there, that we live in an unceded land, and that part of the whole literature is missing, that infrastructure governance, and that part is missing. So we thought, okay, this is the area that our research can progress on. And so you see that the literature review gives us a broad brush picture, very detailed picture, but at the same time, it also gave us some indication what could be the future research.
Thank you, Litten. Yes, it was quite a sobering experience. Litten, as he said, has published many systematic literature review over the years, so we was fortunate to have his guidance over the process. But it was a sobering experience in a sense that we all know about the gap in terms of planning on unceded land, especially in the context of Australia. But it was still the size of the gap, or what we ended up calling the epistemologic silence, on the fact, the reality of infrastructure governance happening on unceded land was nothing like what we were expecting. It basically 97% of the papers that we had identified were silent. They're basically dismissive of such an important fact. And in a sense, that became the leading part of our project. And with that note, we are so lucky that we have Ellie Davidson here with us. Ellie, as Rebecca mentioned before, was one of the leading voices in our advisory board, and we were very lucky to have her. We are lucky to have her as a colleague at the University of Sydney, but we were specifically lucky to have her at the project. And she was one of the members of advisory board that got really engaged with the entire project. She was interviewed. You know, I know that we are supposed to keep, you know, the identity of our interviewees, anonymous, but we are so proud of some of them that we want to tell the entire world. And she was very helpful in terms of even connecting us with other formidable First Nation voices. So, Ellie, this is a topic that is definitely your mission, and I would appreciate if you help us to unpack how infrastructure governance and more broadly planning is entangled with settler coloniality, especially informed by the learnings coming out of Sydney's Western Parkland.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to share. I suppose I didn't have a huge amount on the slides to set the context of LORE versus LAW and governance and how that relates in the Western Parkland City context. So, and just to position myself, I'm a Ballingarra woman from the East Kimberley, so long way off country, both here in Aotearoa, but also where I live on Bundjalung country. And I am privileged to work very closely with Darug people and Darug Noora, who are the traditional custodians of the country that is part of, is the focus of this project. So as Taran said, I was very involved in the advisory group and was quite, thankful that we landed on the Western Parkland City as the focus for the research, because I've been working out there and building relationship and connection with Darug people and Darug Noora over many years. And I suppose one of the things that drives me in my personal and professional practice is a desire for social justice, and the injustice that exists on Darug Noora and the fact that Darug people don't have a legislated voice on their own country is very heartbreaking to me, and something that really kind of influences where I spend my time and my commitment in terms of what I can give back. So even from a personal note, I'm seventh generation descendant of Captain Bligh. His daughter was given a land grant over Wayanamata, which is part of the Western Parkland City. Wayanamata means mother's place, mother's water place. And so actually my ancestors were walking country with Darug people. And I feel, you know, personally committed to trying to shed light on their story. And so from a legislative perspective, in New South Wales, we have the Land Rights Act, which has set up local Aboriginal land councils. In New South Wales, they're not actually required to have anyone who is specifically connected to that country, like mana whenua here, traditional custodians in the Australian context. They don't need to demonstrate connection to place to be on the board of the land councils. They don't have to employ any people who are actually from that place. And actually what happens in the context of these land councils, particularly in Western Sydney and really across the Sydney Basin, is that the land councils refuse membership of traditional custodians like Darug people. So that in itself is a pretty difficult context. And then when you kind of overlay that with what Rebecca shared before, with that wide range of different government bodies that are involved in the decision-making for the Western Parkland City, when you don't have a resourced group of people that have a legislative voice for country, such as an iwi here, or such as the context of some of the Aboriginal corporations that exist in Victoria as an example, it's a really challenging position to be in as a traditional custodian, and their ability to engage with these processes is really tricky, and their voices aren't heard, their knowledges aren't respected, and mostly government agencies don't know who to engage with. And so the point of least resistance is to go to the land council, and then you're talking to people who are off country and actually not, I suppose, coming from that place. A lot of Darug people that I work with and have the privilege of learning from see the land councils as developers, because they have these massive land holdings and resources that they really kind of just use for economic gain and, you know, make a huge amount of money off country that's not there and that they don't have any obligation for. So I suppose that's a positionality piece for myself, but also for this country and the research that we have been involved in. So I suppose just a couple of kind of points relating to, I just like to have a yarn, and this is a research project. So I thought it was good to keep me on track by kind of stepping out some of the things that have happened in this context and some of the outcomes of the research. So I've been really privileged to be involved with the Recognised Country project. We basically created a whole chapter in the Aerotropolis Development Control Plan that requires a response to country. And really what we were trying to do in that project was elevate the voices and the knowledges of traditional custodians. So those legislative gaps that I just highlighted through the DCP and the state environmental planning policy relating to the whole of the Aerotropolis is now required to engage directly with traditional custodians. So trying to, I suppose, empower their voice through a different type of legislation. So decolonizing the system one DCP at a time. And I suppose, yeah, giving them more space with proponents and with governing authorities that would allow for their input to be included and required as part of the process of change. The kind of under-resourcing is really a huge problem. A lot of the people that I work with, part of different Darug corporations, they try to hold down jobs at zoos and doing welcomes to country, and are constantly pulled in so many different directions because they don't have that legislative voice. There's no requirement such as engaging with an iwi here, and those economic kind of systems don't exist. And so it's a very kind of reactive process, but also very relationship based too, because of how busy and how much change is happening. They really have to kind of pick and choose how they spend their time, and I feel very grateful to have built the relationships with the people that I've been able to work with, that they know that, you know, working together does kind of contribute to, you know, the change, and that we create culturally safe environments for them to work with us. The kind of complexity of the system is really challenging. I feel very grateful to have a planning background, First Nations engagement skill set, and I see a lot of the role that I play and the role that industry plays is a translation, like a translator, you know, we're there to kind of help people understand what the legislation does and how it exists and what their roles are, but then also breaking down all of those little boxes that are on there, who's doing what, you know, how they all relate to each other. I'm constantly, I suppose, in that state of reciprocity, where we are learning together. I'm sharing about the planning system and they're sharing about country, and we work together in how that kind of moves forward. Obviously the tight time frame, so I think, like, you know, the context of like how much time a government agency has to think about a particular project, and then these little windows of time where engagement happens, really kind of shifts the power dynamic, because First Nations people are working within this kind of very linear process, not brought in at the start and also not incorporated as a partner really into these processes. So those kind of shifts really need to happen from it being like just an informing state of relating to each other to reciprocity and partnership. So that came through really strongly as part of these conversations. And I think, yeah, just this kind of context of having to work so much like harder to understand how they fit into these systems and where their rights and opportunities are. I suppose just to kind of highlight some of the key like outcomes of these conversations, I think that there's a leaning towards government agencies sort of just doing the informing rather than like sitting and listening. In Bundjalung country, where I'm very grateful to live and work, we have a term called Gungar, to think, to know, to listen, to understand. And that isn't really kind of incorporated into these processes. It's really just like a generally a tokenistic approach of, you know, we're going to tick the box, we're going to come out, we're going to talk to you and say that we did it. But like, what are you actually doing with that information? And I suppose it's one of the reasons why I have started kind of framing the work that we do not just about like seeking to empower First Nations voices, but seeking to empower First Nations knowledges, because it's not about just what you hear, but it's about what you mean and how that can inform the outcomes and the work that you're doing. So that's a really big gap, I think, in the current state of play in the Western Parkland City. And I think that that kind of goes to the next point. Obviously, the term voice in Australia is quite contentious given the recent outcomes of our referendum. But this kind of, I think that the go-to is we'll set up these advisory committees, which is really what was proposed on a national level, and we will listen to you, but then we get to decide what happens to what you tell us. You know, there's no sharing of power, there's no ability for First Nations people to be for them to be given voices and authority in the decision-making process. So I think that was a really key kind of outcome, is that we need to kind of rethink what these systems that we're setting up really look like, and actually allow for First Nations people to be around the decision-making table, rather a separate room, and the outcomes can be taken to, you know, whatever fits the purpose. And this whole process of listening to country, I mean, I think that we've heard so much in this conference about the value of First Nations knowledges as they relate to country and how much they can inform better decision making. This whole conference has been filled with, people's research that is really trying to solve these big problems that we have relating to city making, relating to infrastructure, and we have, knowledges that exist in these communities that can really help to inform better outcomes. And I think that the last point there is just about that piece around reciprocity and how we can really kind of build more equitable foundations for working together in genuine partnership. So I'll leave it there. I've probably spoken more than my 7 minutes.
No, thank you, Elle. That was fantastic. And I think that actually sets the foundation for me to move to Rebecca. So, Rebecca, this is an area of the work that, in a sense, again, you and Glenn mostly championed. And as we said before, Glenn had to leave to catch up an early flight back to Australia. So it would be great if you could please talk about the challenges and opportunities regarding integrated and collaborative infrastructure governance.
So this is a project that is premised on, you know, taking steps towards collaborative governance. And that's really fantastic, especially, you know, with all of the complex things that these place-based projects need to do, but it has taken certain steps which have been very, very welcome, as I said, in, you know, a state and a planning system that has been, you know, very siloed in many different ways for a long time. So I'll talk about the good and the bad and the complex. But one of the things to mention that came through about integration in the systematic literature review is how many different concepts and terms there are related to different kinds of integration. We found, I think, at around 50. And that's, you know, that's reflective, I think, of the way it kind of gets spoken about in the interviews as well. Like, it's a big term that in practice is used in so many different ways that is in danger of course, being meaningless, you know, if we don't kind of develop some more concrete ways of describing what we mean. So first off, on the city deal, again, it was seen as an opportunity. It was seen as something that needed to be an opportunity for broader systemic transformations, because there were so many aspects of the system that were deep barriers to achieving the high aims of this project, even where those aims themselves were in conflict. The city deal came some way towards that, but it needed, as a project, to really be a bigger project of thinking about this whole governance system. I think that's one of my main takeaways. A lot of people were originally skeptical of the city deal, but then came to see, you know, that it was actually making some inroads. It did have a lot of value, especially in terms of bringing local government to the table and setting up sort of new institutions, etc. The city deal funding itself is organised around quite specific, relatively short-term project-based commitments. So that's one of the main criticisms as well, that, you know, it's great for those things, but it's very narrow in its sort of remit and its outcome. The overall funding committed to date is also just vastly inadequate. Even though it's a lot, it's still vastly inadequate for the task, for the aims, for the goals, even at a fairly, you know, limited level. And there was also a lot of concern that we've actually seen play out in the politics, if you're aware of it. There was concern of energy waning, like the importance of energy, the importance of champions, the importance of attention from, you know, key players, politicians, etc., to make this work, to sustain this work. And while there was a lot of that at the beginning, it changed, circumstances changed, people changed, champions left. And in the end, you know, we saw organisations, you know, when we had an election in New South Wales, we saw organisations like the Greater Cities Commission get scrapped, and that's still unfolding. We're still not really sure where that's going to go in the years to come. There were a lot of interesting evolving structures and forums and practices that have reportedly improved integration between government scales. That was kind of, between government scales was really where, you know, the major positive steps were revealed. So this included experimentation with new forums, committees and networks to improve intergovernment collaboration, bringing together different local government voices and interests, and providing some opportunities for knowledge sharing between government authorities and also some joint projects. The resourcing is of particular roles, for example, to design to facilitate collaboration between authorities, was really spoken highly, like how critical, how important that was, that you had specific people with specific excellent skill sets to do that work. They were, you know, widely championed. Even though this is a common thing, practices of staff secondment in this context were seen as being really helpful for helping the perspectives of local government come into state government and the state government perspectives come into local government, et cetera, et cetera. So that human sharing element was really important. And there are also particular examples of successful forums demonstrating the importance of statutorily required regular involvement of key players, people who hold purse strings, people with decision-making powers and influence, to be present in these meetings and to be engaged in the project. And just a part of one of the quotes here, in this project, these approaches, it showed that local government was mature enough and capable enough to get in the room and argue for its own needs and own interests, and capable enough on the back end of that to actually deliver on those. What we found through the process was that despite the fact that it was multifaceted and difficult, the actual decision-making framework for the council stood up and was able to accelerate more quickly than state and federal government in terms of key decision points. It kept honesty in the discussions that councils weren't the third tier partner. We were an equal partner in the process and an equal partner in the outcome. We showed the ways of progressing big decisions through local government can actually be used and worked effectively within the ambit of the system that's there for them. If you deal with us as equals, we will deliver. And that was, you know, certainly there was a lot of shared sentiment around that, but obviously to a limited degree because it was still a very top-down governance situation in terms of, you know, power and funding and whatnot.
Thank you, Rebecca. It was definitely interesting to see that the city deal allowed for the local governments to have their rightful place at the decision-making table. But one thing that stood out to us that was it was not necessarily extended to voices beyond government, to community voices, to NGOs, to activists. And that is what takes me to my next question for Crystal about the politics in infrastructure governance and the way it contributes to the question of accountability.
Great, my favorite question. So infrastructure has a politics, and that politics has a structure, right? And I'm going to try not to go into structural gaslighting because that is still where my brain is at the moment. But the politics, to understand urban politics is really important and how it plays out in infrastructure planning. When we think about politics, we tend to go directly into big P, you know, party politics and thinking about how, you know, constituencies are acquired. Pork barreling are typically the examples that we look to. But small P politics also really matters. And small P politics is really problematic for governments because small P politics creates risk. It creates uncertainty, it can stop projects, it can slow down projects, it can land projects in legal, long drawn out legal processes. So one of the ways in which planning seeks to protect infrastructure is to de-risk it. Is to de-risk it and to depoliticize it. And one of the great examples of how they do that was shown in an earlier slide that Rebecca showed, and that was the spaghetti mess, which is urban infrastructure governance. It's very, very messy. So to try to navigate through that, to identify who is accountable for certain aspects of that process, and those processes are long and they are indeed complicated. But if you can't identify a person or an agency, it can be really difficult to figure out who you are in conversation with in planning. And if you don't have a body that you are in conversation with, it could feel like that you're screaming out into the void, but no one's listening. And through the work that I've been doing, and I have to also just say that I had some distance with this particular case study because I'm based in Melbourne, not in Sydney, but having still participated in a number of the interviews and thinking theoretically through this project, it illuminated much of what I think we're also seeing in Victoria in terms of the politics of infrastructure planning. And that is, the systems are designed to ensure that the politics is controlled and managed. They do that through particular forms of participation, which is to remain committed to this thing, this idea of we're going to hear you, we're going to listen to you, we're going to bring you into the room, but otherwise the decisions are being made elsewhere through elite networks. And those elite networks are concealed from us. They are hidden from us. Partly it's because of the spaghetti of the governance system that seems to get composed when we see complex projects like this one being delivered. Like, I don't have an answer for how to do that in a more seamless way. perhaps the answer is to not do it in a seamless way, though, right? Perhaps the answer is about the conversations we're having. So it's less about accountability, although I think accountability is still important, but more about transparency. And I think these two things need to be brought together in conversation. We don't do those two things well anywhere, I think, when it comes to infrastructure planning, whether it's this project or it's any other project. And I think it's ripe for discussion and for critical research with practitioners. And I think that's the really hard thing. I think the practitioners that wanted to engage with us with those 56 interviews that we conducted as a team, it was really important that they were de-identified because there was hesitation to get involved, right? Because it's not just political insofar as it will get, you know, put up into the media, or there's a risk that it will land itself in a lengthy legal system. It's political because jobs are at stake as well. And if you're seen as someone who is speaking out of turn, there could be significant consequences for you. So the politicization as well of the public service, the politicization of the planning process, and the politicization of just the projects by and large is so complex that I don't think we have the analytical tools to really get inside of it and understand it, tease it out, and then hopefully through some kind of prefigurative politics, change it. So this project, I think, raises significant and important questions, and I think that's why there's a series of new projects that will arise out of it. But I'm really excited to have been part of this team. So I think I'll end it there.
Yeah, I just I thought that there might be a good example to kind of build off what you have just shared in the naming of the new city. A couple of years ago, there was a call for the naming of the new city, and even the framing and the wording that got put out by a government agency around that was, you know, people who created our amazing state, and it was all kind of geared towards this colonial mindset around people who've created it to be as it is now. There was maybe a reference to heritage, nothing about culture, nothing about country. And then the panel that was established, there was no First Nations representation on that panel, and the decision making around, you know, the chosen name that was apparently guised as some, you know, community engagement process the information that sat behind that was not revealed, as you said. And then the name Bradfield came out, and, you know, I reflected on it afterwards, and I was like, I feel like it was almost kind of geared, you know, that something political behind the scenes happened. I have heard references to politicians and ministers being involved in the back end of that, and it's quite confronting because the amount of not just public but like people in industry. I work a lot with people from the Department of Planning and from the Greater Cities Commission, and like everybody in the industry was absolutely shocked and horrified. And I think a lot of us actually even had a hard time saying the word Bradfield. I was like, you know, that new city that's just been named, like it was quite traumatizing. I've come to terms with it now. But, you know, Bradfield is like a white dude that helped to, you know, design and engineer the Harbour Bridge and a dam, like just no context to this particular place. And also, as I mentioned before, this is like women's country, like Waina Mata sits and goes and flows through this place. So it has an innately female quality about it. So like naming it after a white dude that had no reference point is just so crazy and backward. And so I just wanted to mention that as a case study that came out of this research, as well as a reference point to the political nature of how we, you know, the system that we have to work within, because there was a lot of questions and everybody was like, how are we holding people accountable? And the reality is that the council have a naming policy that requires people, any kind of new names, to have a reference point to place, to the context. And so it actually doesn't even align with policies that have been set up and the geographic naming board. I don't know that it's actually been fully recognized by the geographic naming board at the moment because of some of these layers of it not aligning with the policies, you know.
Yes, it still needs to be called out. I completely agree with you. Bradfield naming is definitely highly questionable. part of what is happening in that in that region. And what I can clearly confirm was that out of our 56 interviews, not a single person defended that decision. Not a single person. There were a variety of opinions, all the way from shameful, colonial, regretful mistake, and not a single defense. And there were a lot of questions about who finally made that decision, and we still don't know. So, because no one wants to own that decision that cannot be defended, which I appreciate you bringing that up, Ellie, because we cannot easily give up on, you know, these supposedly symbolic, but very, very important decisions that make the scene for what sort of new cities you want to build and for whom and on whose land and with whose authority. So with that, I'll go to you, Jago. Jago wasn't directly part of the project, but for whoever out there who may not know him, he's definitely one of the thought leaders on the issue of infrastructure in the Australian context. Almost whoever that does work on infrastructure has cited you, you know, in some way or at some point in one of their work. So we were very grateful when you accepted to be discussant on this panel, because we would really like to hear your reflection on the project based on what you heard today, but you also have seen quite a number of our publications and outputs. Because it's important to reflect on the work that we have done. But I think most importantly, it's about repeating the urgency of this area of work on infrastructure governance and perhaps think about future directions. Because one thing that I have no doubt, and Crystal has already mentioned it, is that the work is never, ever close even to be done. If anything, we have only surfaced more questions rather than answers. So we would like to hear from you, Jago.
So, wow, what a task you've put to me. And may I say thank you for the very kind invitation. I mean, I've only occasionally dipped into infrastructure topics, and it's with some degree of envy that I sit here and listen to the opportunity that you've all had to undertake a very detailed and extensive project on a particular infrastructure topic. And I'd congratulate all of the members of the team for the work you've done. It's absolutely fascinating. And I've got to say, it's stimulated a whole bunch of ideas and thoughts of my own. So maybe I'll try and assemble some of those into something coherent. I think the first thing I would say, and going back to a point that Rebecca made, I think it was in her introductory remarks, about the spatial and equitable rebalancing of economic development or economic activity within the Sydney metropolitan area. And part of my reason for opening with that is to tie this back to the development of Sydney as a capitalist economy, right? And big infrastructure projects like a major airport sit within the needs of a growing capitalist economy to, you know, serve the interests of business and, principally in the case of Western Sydney, moving trade goods across the urban environment and internationally. So that's, you know, capitalism with a big C. But then the state is responsible for assembling and coordinating and enabling that infrastructure to be produced to serve the capitalist economy, which then in turn makes it a question of state rule, of state modality, state regulation and so forth. So I guess what I'd like to do is bring a bit of an element of that kind of high-level state theory into the conversation. Because the state is then confronted with this very complex task of assembling not only a major piece of physical infrastructure and the complexity of just simply constructing it, the assembling the materials and the labour to produce it, but is then locating it in a spatial context which is often contested and complex in terms of both the physical landscape that's already there and the interests within that and the governance and the political arrangements around that. So I've been thinking about this case study and interpreting it through kind of notions of regulation, and there's a school called the French School of Regulation, which is about how the state at a very abstract level regulates the internal workings of capitalism. But also going back to some of the theorization that was occurring in the 1990s and early 2000s around notions of governmentality, which is sort of techniques of rule and how different kinds of governmental practices facilitate and enable the state to achieve particular purposes. And so a lot of these practices that I'm hearing you reporting on seem to me about facilitating and enabling the capacity of the state to deliver or achieve this grand objective around the transformation of the spatial economy of Sydney, but doing so in a potentially unruly, uncoordinated, fragmented and very difficult kind of governmental operating environment with tiers of government, obviously federal, state and local, multi-sectoral interest groups, complex relationships between them. And the account you've given seems to me to be an attempt by the state to piece this all together, to integrate these elements of government governance so that the state can be effective in achieving what it's attempting to do. So I guess that's my first initial thoughts, is to think through the kind of underpinning logics of this whole process. But then it comes to kind of more complicated questions of sovereignty, for example, and obviously in the context of Australia, the settler colonial state has asserted sovereignty, yet there's still persistent sovereignty expressed but not necessarily legitimated by the state in terms of the traditional owners. And the ambiguities that the settler colonial state faces in needing to get things done and needing to govern with traditional owners still there, but in an ambivalent position of recognising or not recognising their sovereignty, in part because it would start to contest state sovereignty and an alternative sovereignty, but also recognising that they do need to be accounted for. So there's a kind of a clear ambiguity there, and I think the case of the non-traditional owners being represented on land councils is sort of a reflection of that ambiguity. There's sort of a preparedness to listen to and integrate Indigenous sovereignty, but then there's a weakening and an undermining of it at the same time. So that led me to the idea that governance is itself an infrastructure, in the sense that there's this complex architecture set up. Having dipped into this a bit before for another piece of work I did, it is a very complex governance structure. And so all of this is to try and establish a sort of a socio-technical apparatus or a socio-political apparatus to enable that complex project to be delivered. And it sort of, I came up with the term infrastructure of sovereignty, occurred to me as a kind of a way of partly encapsulating that. But also that there's a temporal dimension to this that I think came out partly in the presentations, which is that this is not just a static arrangement that gets put in place and then it operates and the airport gets delivered and so forth. It's evolving, it's dynamic. There's different interests and politics at play throughout it. I think we heard that in some of the conversation around the interviews with people within different institutions and organisations. There's an animus to it in the sense that it's different points of view are participating in the process, even though it's complicated and problematic to some extent, but certain actors are finding ways to either contest or advance their interests or their institution's interests within what could be seen as a fairly top-down process. For example, the local governments, I think, were mentioned as seeing this as potentially an opportunity to articulate and advance their interests in the spaces in between the sort of the top-down structures. So I thought that was quite interesting as well. And I guess that question of elite networks and sort of who's in control at the very top, but then a kind of, I think maybe I mentioned this before, but a kind of unruliness, the possibilities that this thing could actually spin out into generating its own fractal politics that is a risk for the overarching state. And there's a kind of a Foucauldian term around the unruly subject. And underpinning this, it seems to me, maybe not quite an anxiety, but maybe the word is de-risking, as was used, around trying to make this a calculable space, a manageable space, a manipulable space, which could quite easily be subject to much more florid forms of political contestation, conflict, and all the kind of pitfalls that we know about from the infrastructure literature in terms of, you know, over time, over budget, maybe not even built. We look at other projects like the Snowy 2 scheme, that's kind of currently sinking further and further into a deep hole. So the need to regulate and rule the subjectivities in the system and make sure that everyone's disciplined to the purpose that the capitalist state has, I think, is an element that I would probably bring into it. So,
thank you very much, Jago. Thank you very much for your reflections. And you have definitely given us a lot to think about, because this is something that we will be thinking about for some time to come. Because as we mentioned quite a couple of times before, we haven't figured it out. If anything, we have managed to shed light on some of the areas that need a lot more work. And with that, I'll go back to you guys, our very patient participant, because we are hoping to hear from you guys. If you have any questions, any comments, if something that you want to address to one of our fabulous panelists, yes, please.
You know, we need to be thinking about First Peoples, First Nations, naming places. It helps us. So in the session that I was in before, there was a discussion about place naming and how important it is, because for us as First Nations people, we didn't name places after people, which is another layer of why Bradfield is just so icky. But we name places after like the quality of country. So Wainamata being like a mother's water place, and talking about this very complex system of water. One of the things that is quite horrifying and traumatizing for Darug people, First Nations people in the context of the Western Parkland City, is that if you look at the water systems in the Sydney Basin, you have like the harbour that goes out into the ocean, then you have the Parramatta River, which is kind of where the salt water meets the fresh water, and Parramatta in itself is actually references the eels and the place of where the eels live, and that has to do with the context of that country. And then out in the Western Parkland City, this very complex system of water, which if you look at it on a map, almost looks like an artery. You know, it's like this beating heart, and the context of how the water moves is actually from the south to the north, which is backwards in the way, you know, that that water systems kind of work. And so what is happening in the context of the development around an airport, obviously you need a very and so to jump back, the reason why it is such a complex network is it's really soft, undulating country. So there's these really soft rolling hills, and you know, the context of that place is really characterized by these rolling kind of what is agricultural kind of farmland at the moment, but has been is a Cumberland Plain ecology, and that is characterized by sort of soft grasslands. It was fire country, very well managed through fire practices and cultural burning, with these really amazing stands of trees and complexities around the ecology in the context of where the water is. So, you know, you build a new airport and literally you're flattening it all out, and development surrounding the airport, as has been mentioned, is really focused on infrastructure, large warehouse, you know, developments, which again is about flattening out. And so I've been involved in lots of conversations on country where there's this kind of tension. You know, everybody wants to respect country, and you know, it is required now through the guidelines to recognize country through the DCP process. But like, what does that look like when you want a flat warehouse pad to do these huge logistics developments in the context of country that is soft and undulating? And you know, if we think about the name Wainamata and why it's called that, we wouldn't be flattening everything out, because it's effectively changing the context of country and creating a lot of trauma on country and destruction. And so that's a very long-winded way of saying, like, you know, the context of place naming should really help us to inform what kind of decision making we have around how country should be engaged with, how we should be thinking about country and how it should be used. So there's much more than just naming that comes from from traditional ways of thinking about country, but it talks about the characteristics and the complexities of country and how we should be engaging with her. And so it makes sense for it to be led from that place. And so, you know, I think that whilst there is all this goodwill and there's lots of conversations around, you know, traditional place naming and how important it is, it exists within a political system, and everything really, it comes down to like authority and decision making, because I'm still not sure who the buck stopped with when it came to Bradfield, and that is actually part of the problem. There's no accountability. It's just kind of got caught up in this process, and nobody wants to take responsibility for something that there's been a lot of public and industry backlash from. And yet it still continues. As I said, I don't think that the Geographic Naming Board has technically like endorsed that name. I was part of kind of helping start a bit of a campaign and empowering some of the Darug people that I work with to have a platform to, you know, sign petitions. And we sent that to the Geographic Naming Board, and, you know, there's, but that was a year and a half ago, and we still don't have a formal kind of decision that it's been endorsed. So I don't know, they're not even kind of complying with their own governance structures, which I think is part of the problem.
I mean, we definitely haven't given up in everything that we are writing, and any forum that we are talking about this project, the issue of Bradfield naming comes up one way or another. As Ellie was saying, part of the problem is that we find it very difficult to say it out loud. So, for example, in our conversation pieces, it ended up having the longest title of all time because we didn't want to use the word Bradfield in the title. We just thought that it's not appropriate to use the title that you are, you know, arguing against. So if you see that conversation, you know what I'm talking about.
Look, I just think that the whole system needs to be dismantled and thrown out the window. Like Zoe said in the session yesterday, like, what's the, you know, what is the response to this? And she's like, well, just all the old people need to die. So I will just repeat that, because I think at the end of the day, like, whatever we do, like, in responding to this, we're working within a system that just doesn't work for us, you know. And I suppose you know, my position on the referendum, I kept quite private because I didn't really feel like it was my role to educate other people, or I didn't want to influence other people's. It's essentially just setting up an advisory committee, which is what we heard through this research is an issue. We're not actually questioning power structures. We're not, you know, really kind of thinking about how we move forward in a way that doesn't fit within this kind of colonial system. And I think it was mentioned earlier, like, at the end of the day, like, the people who are in power are going to, it's confronting for them to start to try to shift and give up some of that authority, because, you know, people are selfish, and they've probably spent their whole lives building a career around a system that works for them but doesn't work for everybody. And so I think that, you know, we just need to become a republic, and we just need to get rid of a constitution and a way of being tied to a colonial system, and actually really think about what sovereignty never being ceded and the international laws that were broken to establish a country that we really haven't kind of resolved for ourselves. And at the end of the day, like, a lot of the problems that we need to resolve in our cities and within governance really stem from colonial mindsets and a colonial way of thinking and a capitalist society that would use the land for you know, something to make money and to you know, pillage for our own kind of progress. And I think that the trajectory that we're moving on is really needs to be challenged. And I think that First Nations knowledges and cultural protocols and the way that we see, if we care for country, she will care for us, is a premise that we should be basing all of our future decision making on. So I will stop my rant there, because I could keep going.
It's a great rant. It's a great rant. I mean, if I could offer anything else to that, it would be to reflect on epistemologies and the knowledge is the language, the methodologies, the research approaches that we use to study infrastructure and its governance and its politics, I think. I think as a community of scholars, we have kind of a duty of care to the cities that we are tending to and seek in the communities we seek to support and serve. And I wonder whether or not the ways in which we do research on questions like infrastructure and governance need to be turned on their head. There's a set of methodological questions here in terms of who and what we're serving when we do the research that we do. And if we can't do that brave work as, you know, those of us who are employed at universities, which are presumably still independent, to go out and try to, you know, jostle a little bit, you know, it's going to be really, really tough, because I feel like those in practice aren't in those positions any longer, because the politicization of the public service and of consultancies and all the things within this capitalist system, market-based system, where everyone's always accountable to someone else, but the lines of accountability is drawn on capitalist lines. So to disrupt that requires something pretty fundamental to occur, I think. But that's just my initial thought, kind of hearing you speak, Ellie, and thinking about some of the epistemic silences that were picked up in that piece that you all wrote together.
That's amazing. And going back to Matt's question, because these were the sort of topics that we kept discussing among ourselves as a team about what we're doing. Is it ever possible, you know, to talk about justice on a stolen land, on unceded land? And there was an amazing keynote talk in this very conference when the aim was dismantling the broken system. But in the meantime, we need to do our best to reduce harm. So I think if we remind that, and if we keep that as our basically campus, you know, then it will give us the motivation to continue doing the work that needs to be done while not necessarily losing sight of that bigger agenda that it is not going to be fixed by tweaking. The dismantling and the revolution and the transformation is needed, but in the meantime, reducing harm is really an important responsibility for all of us who are in a privileged position to have a microphone in front of us or a pen in our hand and some audience.
Could I just say one more thing on that? I know I've been talking a bit, but I suppose like the other thing that has really like come to light in this research and in practice, like out in the Western Parkland city, is that, you know, there's a lot of trauma that exists amongst the Darug people about this level of, you know, change and transformation happening out on country. Like in one of the northern, so Wainamata moves from the south to the north and up to the Hawkesbury River around the Penrith area. There's a new suburb that was developed called Jordan Springs, which is actually sinking. And so we're like not just talking about, oh, you know, this nice, like First Nations people want to just keep this land to themselves. They're like actually talking about risk mitigation and future-proofing these communities that we're building. And the fact that the water flows, where the water is moving is already sinking, kind of gives an indication that all of the areas that are being built upon are likely, there's a huge underground water system that exists, and it's an ephemeral water place. And so it's not just this kind of like feel good, we just want to preserve country. There is a real need to listen to First Nations knowledges, because it could help to, you know, save millions of dollars. All of this investment that's happened into a new city being built and this new kind of huge infrastructure focused place has the potential of, you know, not working. And I think that when I consider like infrastructure governance and the importance of working and empowering First Nations people, like when does First Nations knowledges allow for us to just say no? Like, this shouldn't happen here. You know, this is not a good idea for this to occur in this particular place. And you know, I wrestle with that a lot in my practice, because I'm always kind of coming in at a certain point when a government has made a decision about something happening somewhere, and I like intrinsically don't agree with it and I don't believe in it. And it's one of the reasons why I don't work specifically for government, because I'm not there to push this as a really like great thing and tie it up with a bow. but to make sure that First Nations peoples are involved in providing input to something that somebody else has already made a decision around. And I think that that's like the core of what this research is about. It's not just about providing advice into, it's like, should this happen or not? And I think the context of what is likely to occur, like I've lost sleep thinking about water and the context of water in this place and how much it can impact, you know, these grand ideas. We want to kind of rely on Western sciences to engineer out solutions about what we're going to do with water, but I don't think that that holistic thinking and understanding of the cultural landscape has really kind of informed people's decision making about what should happen out there.
Picking up on those thoughts, I mean, obviously that region is also highly exposed to climate risk, obviously through the water, the hydrological cycle and more intensive hydrological events, but also the heat impacts that are, you know, widely known in Western Sydney. And something we haven't really discussed is it's an airport, right? So it's one of the most carbon intensive, greenhouse forcing kind of forms of infrastructure we could come up with. So there's a kind of an irony there. There's de-risking going on in terms of the delivery of the thing, but it's simply adding to macro scale planetary level risk that will then have to be de-risked through probably, as you've identified, Ellie, the engineering interventions and other kinds of adaptation and emergency response. So I think, you know, at a fundamental kind of planetary macro level, there's something problematic about this whole venture, even though on a planetary scale its contribution to emissions might be relatively minor, but it's still entangled in these anthropocentric behaviours.
And one of the things that the DCP and the development around the Aerotropolis has required is like an aero safeguarding requirement, which means that you can't plant certain species of trees in certain areas because of the attraction of birds. So like there's this whole kind of commitment to country, and yet we can't attract birds in these particular areas because we need to safeguard the plains. So there's like all of these layers of trying to, you know, kind of de-risk what they're doing in terms of the airport, and then this kind of conflict in terms of recognizing country and, you know, how those things don't meet eye to eye has been a really interesting conversation.
And it's worth saying that a lot of our interviewees expressed in the, you know, de-identified interviews that they hope the project fails, you know.
Yet that's actually quite sobering experience to talk to quite a number of mid-rank, high-rank government officials who, in the safety of anonymous research interviews, would basically say that was their personal but professionally informed hope for this actually not necessarily to go ahead at all, but be reduced or diminished, or, you know, certain aspect of it basically be reconsidered. And none of these people would basically say that openly, as Crystal mentioned before. None of them would go on record with those professional observations and assessment. But as you guys can see, although we are somehow officially bringing this project to an end with this panel, but this is something that still keeps us awake at night. We are definitely not done with this project, and we will be using any opportunity that we have to promote the voices that have been ignored and to raise some of the issues that may have been settled for some, but are still very much unsettling and concerning to others. Thank you very much. You've been an amazing audience, and thank you very much, you guys, for being amazing over the last, not just 3, 4, 5 years, because we've been, you know, for a long time with this project since the start. It was one of those projects that was supposed to start before COVID, but the COVID delayed it. So that is why we've been thinking, talking, and working on it for almost 5 years, and officially 3 years. And thank you.